My name is David Wee, and this is a session called, I think I entitled it, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, Why Life Imitates Baseball. And I need to give a little explanation of why I'm interested in this topic and why we're doing this. I'm a professor at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, and for the last 15 years or more, I've been teaching a course about baseball and American values at St. Olaf. And it's always perplexing to students and their families, especially, I think, when they report
that
they...
The ones paying the tuition, yeah.
They've signed up to take a course on baseball, and but they still do it, and we have a good time with it. Although some people think that, obviously, what would you do in a baseball course but sit around and chew and spit and scratch and talk about the World Series. I find that the study of sport, and baseball is my favorite part, spectator sport, that the study of sport and baseball in particular is a fascinating way to get at some things about who we are as a nation and who we are as individuals. I'm constantly fascinated by the issue of why it is that I spend more time reading box scores than reading poetry, even though I'm a literature professor. And this puzzles me a lot, but I do it anyway. I should ask you, how many of you spend more time reading the newspaper reviews of opera and ballet than you do reading about sports events? Nobody. Well, now...
We don't have those in our
paper. Oh, you don't? Well, I think we'd all agree, whether we ourselves are the guilty parties or not, in our country, many of us have a fascination, if not a fixation, on sports. Not just professional sports, but sports at all levels. And we spend a great deal of time talking about it, thinking about it, paying for it, either through tickets or through taxation or whatever. We devote an immense amount of national and individual energy and thought and attention to sports. And baseball is the sport that has been called America's national pastime. There are people who would challenge that and think that football has overtaken baseball as the Central American sport, or that basketball is more important. Will soccer ever be as interesting in our country as it is in all sorts of other countries? But baseball, historically, and maybe even still at present, is the sport that Americans identify with more than any other. A famous French historian named Jacques Barzun once wrote that if you want to know the heart and mind of America, you have to learn baseball. And I think that was a fairly perceptive comment about getting at the American character through studying baseball. Well, I teach a course on baseball that is really an interdisciplinary kind of course. We get at all sorts of things. We don't just talk about the World Series. I've put up here a list of some of the areas of study in academics that we get into in a course on baseball. There's a lot of American history connected with baseball, and some of the fascination of baseball has to do with its history, and I would warrant that a lot of us here in this room know a lot about baseball history and can identify time periods based on who was playing when, and you know when Babe Ruth set new records for hitting home runs and so on. There's a great deal of wonderful literature about baseball, and that's not true about most other sports in our culture. You know, people don't write great novels about hockey or wrestling. Baseball is the one, and some of our great writers some of our very best writers in this century have taken up baseball as their topic. And the one American novel that is entitled The Great American Novel is by Philip Roth, is about baseball. So there's a lot of wonderful literature that I can use as a literature teacher in a course like this. Now Hollywood has taken up baseball big time. There have always been movies about baseball. Even Ronald Reagan starred in a baseball movie. And there have been countless bad baseball movies turned out over the years. And now we're getting some very, very good ones. And I know that many of you have seen The Natural or Field of Dreams or Bull Durham or A League of Their Own. Excellent movies about the sport. I'm a teacher of language. Baseball terminology has become a part of our American language to a great extent. And later, if we have time, we'll talk about the baseball metaphors that are part of the coinage of the realm in our everyday language. Get into psychology. One of the things that fascinates me is team loyalty. How many of you have a favorite baseball team? Okay, what are the teams that you...
Baltimore Orioles.
The Baltimore Orioles.
The San Francisco Giants.
San Francisco Giants.
Yeah.
Seattle Mariners.
That's sad.
Twins.
The Minnesota Twins, all right.
Oh, there's nobody else near us, is there?
Any other favorite teams in
Braves.
Here? Which?
The Braves, Atlanta Braves.
The Atlanta Braves, okay. Any others in the room?
Philadelphia Phillies.
The Philadelphia Phillies, okay. Now, you mentioned there's no other team nearby.
Yeah, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming.
Do you all?
Colorado Rockies. Giants are closest.
One of the things is that
most
of us choose as our favorite team the team closest to us, but not always.
To our birthplace.
Or to the birthplace, where you discovered baseball as a child and where your first affections were. Some people are always a Braves fan or always a Giants fan because that was the team you loved first. And if they move clear across the country, as the Brooklyn Dodgers did in the 50s, so there are some people living in Brooklyn and New York who are always Dodgers fans. They can never root for anyone else, even though their team is 3,000 miles away. Others living in Brooklyn and New York couldn't stand to be Yankees fans because they'd spend a lifetime hating the Yankees. But when the Mets were created out of whole cloth, they became Mets fans, found a new team. But why is it that some of us become fanatics about the local team when we recognize they're all just a bunch of hired mercenaries, right? They don't live where we live or didn't grow up there, most of them. They're paid big bucks to come and play, and why should we attach our loyalties to them?
And they'll get traded and they'll play just as hard for the other team.
That's right. Why do we do that? And why do whole cities go wild when the team wins the World Series, or, you know, almost wins it? And then why does nobody show up at the ballpark the next year when, like Toronto and the Phillies, you know, they're having a bad year and they're in last place? It doesn't always happen, but some fans just quit coming when the team isn't winning. What does it say about us? What's going on here in our loyalty and in our attention to the game? Sociology. It's fascinating to me. The way in which professional sports in the last few decades has been one of the few ways in which many marginalized peoples have been able to make it into mainstream American culture through sport. One of my favorite stories about baseball has to do with Jackie Robinson became the first black man to be able to play in the major leagues in this century. There were a couple prior to 1900, but blacks had to have their own league because they weren't allowed to play in the major leagues until Jackie Robinson was hired by Branch Rickey and very carefully orchestrated plan to break the color barrier in baseball a decade and a half before we managed to do it in national politics. The first time the Brooklyn Dodgers, with Jackie Robinson as the first modern black player, played in a southern state, which was Missouri, and they were playing the St. Louis Cardinals in the National League. The first time the Dodgers made a road trip to St. Louis, and therefore the first time a black person was going to be playing in a southern state, the Cardinals declared that they would not take the field against a team playing a black man. And Ford Frick, who was president of the National League at the time, sent a message to the St. Louis Cardinals: if you do not take the field and play against the Brooklyn Dodgers, none of you will ever play another Major League Baseball game in your lives. And he had the power to do it. Now, this is just one of the fascinating things about the commissioner and league president situation historically, is that they had the power to do that. So, sociologically, wonderful things have happened, especially for marginalized people who've learned to play a sport. Now we see it more spectacularly in professional basketball, but it's been going on in baseball since at least 1947. Economics. We could talk endlessly about the economics of American sport. And, you know, why do we pay Kirby Puckett, you know, $6 million a year to play a child's game? Just because he plays it pretty well. And, you know, people are going hungry and, you know, programs are going unfunded. But we go ahead and participate as spectators, sometimes reluctantly, when the salaries get to be that high, or when a utility infielder batting 235 is also making $1 million a year. But still, it's part of American sport. And why should that be? Aesthetics. Baseball is a beautiful game. One of the reasons some of us love it is because of the beauty of it, the geometries. Walking into a stadium with that green grass just takes your breath away sometimes.
Except Minnesota.
Except Minnesota, Seattle, Houston. Domed stadiums are another sad thing, but they have a lot to do with economics. The one thing we can say is that if we didn't have the King Dome in Seattle and the Metrodome in Minneapolis, we wouldn't be able to see Major League Baseball in those cities. So I'm grateful for a dome stadium, much as I hate to see baseball inside. We have to make trade-offs. But it is a beautiful game. Some people think. Others think it's boring and don't understand why some of us pay such exquisite attention to what's going on. But some people are noticing things that others aren't noticing.
Jeff? Well, I was just raising my hand.
We'll work on you. Metaphysics. The nature of games is a fascinating thing. Most games that are played with a ball or a ball-like object, like a puck, are territorial games where the players defend the home territory against the invaders. And the main point of these games is for the attacking team to move this object into enemy territory and into the home turf, right? It's very warlike. There's a kind of invisible vertical plane that is the goal line or the front of the net in hockey or soccer. And the idea is to penetrate that vertical plane and score points by doing that more often, by invading the opposition more often than they cross your borders. Very, very warlike. One of the fun things about basketball is that James Naismith, when he invented basketball, was trying to solve the problem of all the body contact that these kind of sports, you know, require, because everybody lines up between the ball and home, and you just hit each other to try to keep that ball from crossing into your territory. He said, I know how we can avoid body contact. We'll take that vertical plane that the ball has to penetrate, and we'll raise it 10 feet in the air, and we'll make it horizontal and require that the ball cross that plane from above. There's no way that people can get in between the ball and the plane that it has to pass, right? He would be amazed to see what's happened since the old days when people just tossed up the easy
the two-handed
shot.
Set shot.
Yeah, the two-handed set shot. Another question? Okay. Anyway, the very metaphysics of a game, how it works, what's the concept, what's the theory behind a game? You know, in baseball, it's one of the few ball games where the offensive team is not allowed to touch the ball. In almost all other games, the offensive team is always touching the ball. And instead of invading somebody else's home, the object is to start at home and come around to home again, yourself, instead of getting in the way of that. Although there is a little bit, the catcher is often standing between home and another player who's trying to get there. But you try to send the ball away and go on a trip and come home instead of doing this more warlike thing that other ball games do. Ethics is a fascinating part of sport. One of the most famous things that ever happened was the Black Sox scandal. What year?
1919.
Okay.
And, I know your history.
You know your history, that's right. The White Sox players took bribes to lose ball games so gamblers could win big bucks. And because of that, the owners of baseball established the first commissioner. You know his name, too.
Judge.
No, he was later.
Kennesaw
Mountain Landis. Named after a mountain.
Because we have no history as well as we have.
But in order to prevent cheating, which people in America thought was so important, if baseball, of all things, could be subject to cheating and gambling, this would be such a violation of what's sacred to Americans that they established a commissioner with absolute powers to kick anyone out of baseball for life, which he did to some of those players, even though they were proved or determined guilty by the or innocent by the jury, he kicked them out for life anyway. And this has spawned novels like Shoeless Joe, which was the basis for Field of Dreams. Almost every great American baseball thing has to do somehow with the Black Sox scandal. Now the movie is Eight Men Out that some of you have seen, and that's the eight men who were kicked out by Landis. Religion is one of the things I like to talk about most in connection with baseball, and we'll do some of that together. It's a little frightening when you begin to think of all the ways in which our attention to sport is like our attention to religion. And we'll talk a little bit about all the similarities, the common behaviors that we do in connection with sport and with religion. Mathematics is a part of baseball. Probability is one of the key things that we think about when we're watching. One of the marvels about baseball is I think about what it is that makes it so fascinating to many people. Most of us, it's a game where most of us can anticipate because of our knowledge of probability and our knowledge of history and player performances and strategy, that we can anticipate what's going to happen next. You know, if a pitcher gets two strikes on Kirby Puckett and the count is 0-2, you can be pretty sure that the pitcher is going to throw a very bad pitch, low and outside, and there's a pretty good probability that Kirby will swing at it. Now, the pitcher will throw an unhittable pitch, and Kirby will swing at it, and he'll hit a double. just the mathematics about whether it's strategically sound to ask a player to steal the base or to have use the sacrifice bunt rather than hitting away makes the game a constant puzzle and fascination. And of course the numbers, everything is counted in baseball, every pitch, every offensive act, every defensive act. And I'm not sure there's any other sport where on any time a player touches a ball, something goes into the record books as an assist or a put out or an error or a hit or a stolen base or a wild pitch or whatever. So we count everything. And some of you are probably like me, who grew up knowing the batting average of every player in the major leagues. Every week we read those long lists in the Sunday paper and keep track, and you know whether your hero is going to win the batting championship or not. Mathematics is a very important part of baseball fascination. And physics is even involved. One person has written a whole book on the physics of baseball. People have argued for decades on whether the curveball actually curves. Just ask any AAA player who goes up to the major league for the first time and faces
like Michael Jordan.
Like Michael Jordan, right? Yeah. Anyone, it seems, can hit a good fastball, but a major league curveball really does curve, and it's hard to hit. Anyway, physics is a fascinating part. So when I teach a course on baseball, it's not just literature, it's not just athletics. There's a whole realm of inquiry that's important to us, that I think it's important for us to think about, because if we think sports aren't important, I think we're walking around with blinders. They are important to many, many people in our country. Rightly or wrongly, collectively as Americans, we spend much more attention to baseball than we do to poetry, to drama, to ballet, to opera.
Anthropology up there. And I think more than any of the others, ologies, it's about the study, you know, understanding of our culture.
Sure. Thank you. And probably a few more that you can think of as well. Well, one thing that I do when I'm teaching the course, we begin each class with what I call batting practice. So we get warmed up a little bit, and I usually ask a few trivia questions about baseball. And there are good trivia questions and there are bad ones. I mean, I could ask you what second baseman led the league, the American League, in triples in 1923, and who cares? You know, that's not important, although some people know the answer to that kind of question. But many of the trivia questions, to me, are really fascinating, simply that such a thing could happen. For instance, one Major League Baseball player hit a home run in his very first time at bat in the major leagues, and about 50 players have done that. But this player played for 20 more years in the major leagues and never hit another home run. I think that's wonderful. The probability of that happening is just tiny, but it did happen to Hoyt Wilhelm, who was spent most of his career as a relief pitcher. And I read, as a knuckleballer, I read recently that another player hit a home run, and I can't even remember his name, he's not a famous person and didn't have a long career, but he hit a home run in his first time at bat in the major leagues and in his last time at bat in the major leagues, and hit only a handful of homers the rest of his career, but first time up, his last time up, came in and went out with a home run. That could happen is just amazing to me. One player on his last time at bat in his major league career hit into a triple play. Yes?
A trivia question related to some of this probability. About how many at-bats a season are there?
Well, a lot of you can answer that. You have to have 3.1 at bats for every game your team plays.
I don't mean per person.
Oh, you mean
total?
Total for the whole league?
Yeah, total at bats.
Well, somebody knows the answer to that.
That's the base rate that you need in order to understand how likely some of these are to happen.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Well,
here's
a researcher, you know. The astonishment that some of these things can happen depend in part on answer to your question. How many times does somebody swing a bat? And it's, you know, tens of thousands of times. A typical starting player will bat about 500, 550 times in a season. But the person who hit into a triple play in his last at-bat was a member of the 1962 Mets, of course. The most feudal team in the history of baseball. They lost 120 games. And this was Joe Pignatano. Some of you remember the name. Who hit into the only all-Cuban triple play? This is a well-known person. Well, the person who did it, of course, that doesn't matter, but it was Whitey Herzog, who had a distinguished career as a player and a manager and now a general manager.
Perhaps Justice's name should be Whitey.
Yeah, yeah. Getting into anthropology here again. See if I can get the names right. He was playing for Kansas City against the Washington Senators in 1960, and he hit into a triple play that went from... Who was the first really good Cuban pitcher for the Twins? He was the Twins' best pitcher back in the... Camilio Pascual to Julio Baquerto to Jose Valdivielso. That was the triple play. Well, but, I mean, while these are interesting, other trivia questions really tell you more about the game and how it works. One of my favorites is this one. What major league pitcher who pitched more than just a few decisions, what major league pitcher has the best lifetime pitching record against the New York Yankees? Who's been the most successful pitcher against the New York Yankees?
Maybe Bob Gibson.
He didn't play in the same league, so... It was Babe Ruth.
Oh, yeah, he pitched for the Orioles.
No, he pitched for Boston.
For the Boston Red Sox. Yeah. Now, most people who know a little bit about baseball know that Babe Ruth is the biggest name in all baseball history, and that he was famous for hitting home runs for the New York Yankees. But before he joined the Yankees and became a full-time outfielder, he was the best left-handed pitcher in the major leagues. And began his career as a pitcher for the Boston Red Sox and was more successful as a better winning percentage against the Yankees than any other player in the history of baseball. And that's a fascinating thing because there's all sorts of historical kinds of things that play into that. Talking about numbers, I bet you together we can all come up with a significant for the benefit of the tape audience. 406.
Ted Williams
is the last player to hit 400 in the season. 2,130.
Pete Rose.
Lou Gehrig. Consecutive games.
Okay, it's the number of consecutive games that Lou Gehrig played in. And Cal Ripken is working his way. He's about two seasons away.
Next three and a half.
If he can continue, he may break this. But 56
consecutive hits.
Games.
Joe DiMaggio, the number of...
Hitting streaks.
56 consecutive games in which he got a hit. 61.
Roger Maris.
Roger Maris.
Most home runs in a season.
Most home runs in a season, 61. See, we all know these. The fact that you just look at these numbers and you all know what they mean is really interesting. 90 feet.
First base.
Okay, so the distance between the bases.
Yeah.
60 feet, 6 inches.
Pitcher's mound to home plate.
Okay, the pitcher's rubber to home plate, actually. 1941?
I'm not sure.
No, that was 47. That's pretty close. What happened in 1941?
World War I, there were two starting.
All right, we're back to history.
DiMaggio was 56
games. Okay, both of these things happened in 1941. Wonderful year. 755?
Hank Aaron.
That's the record for the most number of home runs in a career by Hank Aaron. Okay. 511? We're getting a little tougher now.
Mickey Mantle? Home runs?
No. Well, that's probably about how many he hit. This is a pitching one.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Most wins?
Most wins in a career.
Oh, really?
Is it Walter Johnson?
No.
Warren Spahn.
Cy Young. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Warren Spahn holds the record for the most wins by a left-hander.
Left-hander.
363.
And isn't that about 200 more than most than the next closest pitcher?
Yeah, when pitchers get 300 wins, they're a fix on getting into the Hall of Fame. Yeah. That's sort of the ultimate career goal is 300 wins. .300?
That's just kind of a magical.
It's magical.
Yeah.
Certainly more
superstar.
That's a standard for, if you bat 300 in a season, you're really
$6 million.
Yeah, then you're going to $6 million. And Ted Williams pointed out that hitting a baseball is the toughest individual thing in all of sport. You fail 7 times out of 10 and you're a superstar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, it's just marvelous. In 100?
Is that the RBIs?
100 RBIs in a season is the standard people go for. And of course,
home pitching
20 is the number of home wins in a season.
Pitching.
Superstar.
15.
Which you have to.
Not the line of futility?
This is the Mendoza line. it's considered to be a baseline of batting futility. It's the lifetime batting average of Mario Mendoza, who served as a kind of feudal person. Some people think 200 is a better line. That's the Bob Uecker line. He had a lifetime average of 200. And then this one was added by a member of the audience just before we started. 8.
Consecutive home runs by
Hank. 8 is the number of consecutive games, the record, the number of consecutive games in which a player hit a home run. And Ken Griffey tied that last season. Some folks were there. My daughter was at that game. Bill was at that game. It was Lutheran night at the Kingdom. So. All the Lutherans got to see this.
So the Twins and they lost.
After
they beat the Twins. Or who won the game?
No, Minnesota won.
Twins won the game.
They beat Randy Johnson.
How many Lutherans do you have to have Lutheran night?
Good question. You know who had the previous record? Doesn't matter.
Aaron?
Dale Long, the Pittsburgh Pirates, way back in the 50s. Okay, this is one of the games where many of the players are known simply by their nicknames. And it's amazing how many players we know their nickname, but we don't know their real first name. But you can rattle off the names of all these players.
Duke Snyder.
Babe.
Ruth.
The Splendid Splinter.
Tip Williams.
The Yankee Clipper.
Who would imagine?
Hammer and Hank.
Aaron.
The Yogi.
Bear.
The Sultan of SWAT.
Ruth.
Babe Ruth again. Pee Wee.
Reese.
Scooter.
Phil Rizzuto.
Rapid Robert.
Robert?
Filler.
Bob Filler.
No.
Okay. Dizzy.
Dizzy.
Okay, so you know all these.
Just got glued up there.
I've got a few more to test you that I was thinking of while I was out running today. Chief.
Chief Bender.
Chief Bender.
Pitcher.
Wonderful pitcher.
Indian.
He was Indian. Every Native American player who's ever been in the big leagues has had the nickname Chief.
Tradition.
It's an automatic. One of the most recent was Mark Salas of the Twins. They called him Chief. The Iron Horse. That's Lou Gehrig. Yep. Whitey.
Whitey
Ford. Whitey Herzog. Vinegar Bend. Mizell. See how these names just come back? You haven't thought of them for years. The Man.
Stan
Musial.
Boog.
Pal.
Got a Baltimore one in here. Catfish.
Hunter.
Blue Moon.
Blue Moon Odom.
The Fordham Flash.
Ooh. Frankie Frisch.
Frankie Frisch.
He was at this last year.
Yeah. He was studying for a year just for this night. All right.
This is half the answer to one of the great baseball trivia questions, which is which two Fordham University second basemen later became Cardinals? And of course, one is Frankie Frisch, the Fordham Flash. St. Louis Cardinal second baseman. The other was Francis Cardinal Spellman. He became another kind of Cardinal. Right. Here's one of my favorite nicknames, Dr. Strange Glove. Anyone know who this one is?
Yeah. No, played the outfield for Oakland and lots of other people.
Yeah. The first one we had, this was Dick Stewart of the Pittsburgh Pirates, who was a very inept fielder at the time that Dr. Strangelove movie came out, so he became Dr. Strangelove. And my all-time favorite one is The Ancient Mariner.
Gaylord Perry?
Yeah.
Gaylord Perry. He was playing for the Seattle Mariners at age, what, 45 when he finally quit? But this used to be a generic nickname for any bad fielding shortstop. Morris, do you remember the opening lines of Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner? It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one in three. Yeah, that's right. But in fielding, that's not really good. Okay. Well, we could go through a whole list of nicknames, and it's fun to realize how much these have stuck. Because the personalities and the performance of players stay with us. And when you follow a team or follow the sport, there are certain, even the gestures, even the swing or the run or the warm-up of a player has its own distinctive individuality that people recognize. And the nicknames stick with them as well.
Is there some commonality from which nicknames come? From the players, from the broadcasters? Has anybody looked at that?
Well, most typically they come from the players themselves, from teammates who like to kid a teammate about some quirk. Although there are announcers who make careers out of inventing nicknames for players, usually pulling some pun on their name or their hometown. Vinegar Bend Mizell grew up in Vinegar Bend, Arkansas. It was his hometown, you know. That's how he got his nickname, and some of them get them that way.
Yeah, and I know that Catfish was a marketing ploy.
That was invented by the team to
market
him. Yeah.
Finley, I think.
Okay. But I think the most typical thing has been teammates.
Along that line, when you say that every Native American who's played is called Chief,
Is that the only example of the kind of labeling or marketing?
Well, Jewish players, I guarantee, have not been called rabbi. Sandy Koufax is not called a rabbi.
He's called a lot of other things.
Yeah. He didn't play on Saturday.
I don't know if there are any other kind of ethnic or racial common terms. Can anyone think of any? Not sure of any, but often, you know, every player for years who wore glasses were called specs, you know, and you know, there are certain things like that that are almost generic.
What's the derivation of doc? Because there's been a lot of players being called doc.
Well, some have been doctoral students or actually have become doctors of medicine or doctors of philosophy or doctors of law, and usually if they're intellectual in that sense or academic, they'll get that nickname.
You know, Doc Gooden got
it. Yeah, I don't know how Doc Gooden, but there was a pitcher for the Yankees a few years ago named Doc Medich, I think was his name, and he was a doctor. Well, let's get to a few questions, and then I would think it would be fun to get at the religious aspects of baseball and sport. Do you have a sense of why it is we care so much about sports and baseball in particular? You know, why do we know all this stuff? Why could we answer all these really insignificant details about people and numbers? Do you have a sense of why that's true for yourself or for some friend you know or a member of the family you've never been able to understand? You know, my children, for Father's Day last month, bought me a baseball glove. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm 55 years old and I'm still getting a new baseball glove. So. But it was a perfect gift for me.
Identity.
Yeah.
Identity.
Yeah.
There's such a lot. I mean, I guess what I wonder about is, you know, in the early part of the century, I think it was identity in the sense of the melting pot notion that it served to help people. You know, it was one of those rituals that allowed people to see themselves as all the same, because what identified me was whether I was Irish or Jewish or Italian or whatever, but I was a Yankee fan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
More recently, I think it's a different need, which is that people don't know where to locate how they fit in to the larger mm-hmm. society. And so, you know, we get to the point now where even our fashion is, you know, is dictated by, you know, how we dress even is dictated more by, you know, that we're looking for identity in that way.
And we do, you know, sports team
fashion is
clothing is one of the huge
more money is made.
Things. Yeah,
the San Jose Sharks, which I'm familiar with, because.
Yeah.
Made three times more money as a business on their clothing this year than on television revenue or anything else. I mean,
it's insane. Yeah.
That's how they're existing.
Yeah. So we have this need to identify.
Yeah.
And,
along that line, I'd ask a question. Would it be fun to know these things and not talk about them with someone?
It's a.
Does that question make sense?
Yeah, sure, because I think it is an impetus for community building.
Right.
Even though it's tragically a very poor common denominator.
It's harmless, at least.
Yeah. I mean, you can get a conversation in Atlanta about the Braves just like that, and break any kind of barrier that would exist between you and the person sitting on Martyr or whom, wherever you are. And immediately then doors are open at least for some sort of commonality.
Yeah, and that's not...
And the good days and the bad days.
Yeah, and that's not specific to baseball, but to sports teams in general.
True,
yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Of
course.
Yeah, I was going to say something in general to sports teams too. I think it's connected with your point, but I don't think it's tragic. I think people want to be fanatic about something that's not much at stake. There are political issues where if they differ with their friend, there's quite a bit at stake. And those are harder for us to be passionate about. But if we're passionate about a team, we know, really, it doesn't matter that much. And so it's kind of fun to be passionate, and even to have your best friend favor another team. Or, you know, go talk about teams together.
Yeah.
I have a hunch that might be part of it.
The word I use is trust, because there's very little left if you would take that away. If that would get us to a deep
yeah.
That's what yeah. I mean. No, I don't see it as yeah. harmful in itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I'm glad you have it.
Yeah.
To a certain degree.
Okay.
Well, I have a less deeper thought, I guess. I look at it that most people, I think, just need something as an entertainment source.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter probably doesn't know very much. If she looked at these numbers and these words in black, she would probably not know any of them. But she could name a lot of things about movies and plays and
yeah.
musical theater and things of that nature. So I think a lot of this has to do with where your interest lies as an entertainment guy. And that's where it is for me. I love sports. And I follow as much as I can through the written word. And it's just, in my case, it's great entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I choose to do my entertainment.
Yeah.
Rather than going to movies, I'd rather look at a baseball game or football or something along those lines, or read about it, rather than do the other thing.
Reminds me of a full page ad I saw in the Minneapolis paper a few years ago. We have the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, as well as a lot of other good theater. And the Twins used as their promotional slogan at the beginning of the season, "The best plays in Minneapolis this year will be at the Metrodome." So again, they're linking it up with the entertainment. It's like, it's another kind of drama, another kind of theater that people like to go to. Anybody else have a...
What about your students? Our generation seemed to grow up with this, and we were fixated on reading books, like you said, at the scores, and knowing who did this and who
yeah.
played. And what about kids, your students, you find them as knowledgeable? Is this a generational thing, or what about young people coming up? Are they as familiar with these numbers as we are?
They don't all know all of the nicknames of the older players the way we do. They know the current ones much better than I do, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, the world began to crumble when Boston moved to Milwaukee, and we no longer had the same eight teams in the mm-hmm. same cities. And,
yeah, expansion.
And, yeah, it's expansion yeah. And movement began.
It's just too big.
But they pay at least as much attention to sports and to more sports. For back when I was growing up, it was just baseball. And professional football and professional basketball were not that big a deal.
That was in Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's where basketball was.
Yeah, the Fort Wayne Zollner Pistons. And, that wasn't such a big deal for basketball. But now I sense a kind of a broader interest in teams of all sports. Interestingly, the
Cards are really big among
yeah.
the three boys
yeah.
on the basketball.
And their dads. You know.
All of us you know, were kicking ourselves, right?
Yeah.
We're throwing
yeah.
boxes and boxes of cards that made us
yeah.
all millionaires today.
Yeah. Yeah. Another fascinating thing that these little cardboard icons can be so important. And it's not only the little kids. I go a couple times a year to these baseball card shows, and it's people my age who are in there wheeling and dealing and buying lots of things, and as well as the little kids, but they're working with not as much cash.
I like that choice of words that you just had, just to call them an icon.
Yeah. There.
Yeah. Well, that's maybe a good shift over to the religion aspects. I'd like to have us spend 10 minutes, even though we could spend a whole hour, on some of the linkages between religion and sport or baseball. Because part of what I think we need to recognize is how central sport or playing or having some connection with that is to our being. We've used the term Homo sapiens, thinking creature, as the identification of humans, but some believe that we are Homo ludens, and that is creatures who play. I mean, what do you do with your discretionary time? What do people do on weekends?
They think, right?
Yeah, they sit around and think, right?
Not sapien.
We like to play, and if we were given our choice, spend the rest of our life working or the rest of our life playing, what would you choose? What would we as a nation collectively choose? Well, probably many of us would choose to play. And part of it is that we as creatures are one of the things that differentiates us from a lot of creatures is that we invent games with rules and boundaries and so forth, and we like to play them, and then we like to replay them mentally and remember them and talk about them and rethink them and compare players and so forth. Well, what are some of the things that you can think of that are common to both the way we behave about religion and the way we behave about sports?
Yeah. One of the things I was thinking about was how it's kind of a tradition that's passed down from something parents teach their children because they value the importance of it.
Okay, there's a received tradition. And this is how I got my interest in baseball. I got it genetically from my father and my grandfather. It's not my fault. And I could give you all the details about that. But yeah, it's often a family thing passed on, as religion frequently is.
So ritual.
Ritual. There's all sorts of ritual. You know, what precedes every baseball game?
The national anthem.
I was 15 years old before I realized that the last two words of the national anthem were not play ball. And of course, somebody shouted play ball on the 4th of July when we did it. That was you. Okay. All sorts of rituals, both for the whole event as well as for individuals. You know, Kirby Crockett crosses himself every time he steps to bat. Wade Boggs only eats chicken on game days, and the players don't.
Touch.
Okay, what other?
He has other diversions, Bill.
Gathering of community.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mother Day.
Yeah, right.
Okay, when you get into the ballpark and the home team is playing and you're with fans, you start chattering with people you've never seen before and giving high fives when Ken Griffey gets a home run.
Are there scriptures?
Absolutely.
Are there scriptures?
You can tell I'm an outsider.
Get your program right here.
Get your program.
The biggest book in my library is the Baseball Encyclopedia. And you can look it all up. Everything is there. The complete record of every player who ever played in Major Leagues.
But yeah. That would be the scriptures, a book of statistics.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. That would be a... You know, it's the genealogies and the statistics.
Right.
Okay.
It's almost Holy Meal too, with the way it's played out now. I mean, just the refreshments.
Okay.
There, you know.
It's the
even though that's body scratching a point.
Body of God.
Okay. I mean, it's just almost unanimous that everybody.
Okay.
Yeah. You got to play hot dogs. Come on. Right. You got to put. You can't say it's hot dogs.
Okay.
Dog and beer.
Okay. Yeah, right. Hot dogs and beer. I read a wonderful article by Mike Royko, the Chicago columnist, when he discovered that they were going to serve sushi at the San Diego Stadium, decided that this was the end of American civilization.
It's certainly a good sign.
There's a hierarchy. Both within the players and within the system, the establishment. There's a commissioner and then two league presidents.
Well, maybe there's a commissioner.
Seventh day rest, seventh day stretch.
Okay,
very good.
There is hymnody.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's hymnody.
We got to say
at the seventh inning stretch.
Well, then you've always got the theater we're playing.
Okay, is organ music?
Bless my God.
I just love to see church.
But you gotta put money.
It's a concert organ.
Certainly at all.
Okay, you're always giving away money at the game.
Offering?
I would think also you would have your priest.
Okay.
Those players that are almost sacrosanct.
Okay.
Can do no wrong.
Yeah, we have a real idolatry going on.
The saints. The
saints,
the
yeah.
Great saints.
The saints are the, you know, the Babe Ruth, the Lou Gehrig, sure. All these who went before.
If we talk about Lutheranism, we can talk about the uniform.
Uniform.
Dave, I mean, our pastor wears a uniform. Sometimes it changes, but basic same uniform.
Okay.
He looks different from the rest of us.
Is there an afterlife?
Yeah.
You haven't seen the damn Yankees?
The Hall of Fame. It's sure. People are enshrined there forever, and that's called becoming an immortal,
I suppose.
These words.
Not my words.
And only a few seats get into it.
There's a great story about. This is a slight angle on this. The two 80-year-old retired guys who was in Florida who spend their time going to. The exhibition, or the games in spring training. Every day they're out there in the bleachers watching. And Fred says to Joe one day, Joe, do you suppose they play baseball in heaven? And Joe says, well, I've always thought about that too, but I don't know. Well, the next day they were back there again in the bleachers, the same spots. And Fred says, well, Joe, I had a dream last night and then a visitation from an angel, and I've got the answer. And he said, well, what is it? He said, well, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that they do play baseball in heaven. The bad news is you're pitching next Sunday. Well, we've got the everlasting life in the Hall of Fame, the shrine of the greats. Anything else you can think of quickly?
Well, probably the more recent phenomena is that the two fastest growing forms of radio are sports and religious.
Okay.
I mean, those two.
Some of the.
Another one too is the great edifices that we have built to honor and enshrine baseball.
Okay, we've got the
cathedral.
We've got the cathedrals. We've got the. The radio evangelists, you know, the Harry Carries.
Which city, how many cities have a 24-hour sports radio station?
I think Atlanta has two.
Does any city, anybody here not in the city, doesn't have a 24-hour sports radio? All radio, all sports all the time? I thought it was more widespread than. Maybe not yet.
Well, Portland does.
Yeah.
Seattle does.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the same thing about
cable TV.
There's two channels.
A few more quick ones. Our hour's just about up, and we could probably do this for a long time. But
what else do you feel?
Do you have some?
Well, we've got our sacred spaces with our cathedrals. There's a sort of sacred time, right. You know, that
game day.
Sunday noon for professional football. You know, that's where people are going.
Relics also are there, the icons and your all your paraphernalia that goes along with it.
How about theologians?
We do, there are theologians, you bet.
Baseball writers and statistic keepers.
Try a lot of praying at both places.